Good. It looked like law. Either law or another bootlegger. And a bootlegger wouldn't leave his car like that. He watched the cafe across the street, but there was only the shadow of the counterman moving up and down behind the dirty window. He took his change, gathered his overcoat around his hips, and slid in.
"Come again," the garage man said.
Bo pulled away. The trail climbed steadily, second gear much of it, and many curves, the roadbed deeply washed, exposing the solid rock in places. It was no road to make time on, but he rode the throttle anyway. Whoever was waiting back there was asleep at the switch. There was that to be thankful for. But at the top of a long, swinging hairpin, he looked back and saw the moving lights of a car. He swore, clicked off the dash light in order to see better. The road climbed up and up and up, a rocky shelf in the mountain's side. Sometime soon he should hit the top of the pass and start down, and on the other side it was better, not so steep or crooked. But he had to make the pass first. On this side, with a load on, he was at a disadvantage. When he next looked back, the lights were out of sight, but at the next bend he saw them burst around a corner, already closer, coming up on him like a house of fire. He swore and slid the Essex into low, got a start over a steep pitch, slipped into second and stayed there, gunning it, the speedometer needle trembling around 30. His arms and shoulders were set like cement. "By God," he said to the dummy, "if that's the law, they're going to have a ride." Skidding on a curve, he felt the weight of the car haul him sideways, settle, come back to center. The tires shot gravel like bullets up under the fenders. Then there was a flattening, a dropping. The road ahead tilted flat, tilted down. He shifted and settled himself. It was a horse race now. With one eye on the mirror, he counted, waiting for the lights. He was up to 38 when they blazed over the rim, diffused among the pines. That settled it. They hadn't lost much, if any, and nobody would drive as fast as he was driving without good reason on that road. He felt in his overcoat pocket for a box of roofing nails. "Looks like we've got to give these prohies a headache," he said to the dummy. Driving with one hand, he ripped the end out of the box and shook into his palm a heavy weight of nails, big-headed, an inch and a half long. He unbuttoned the side curtain all down one side, losing time in doing so, and when he was ready he saw that the lights had gained more. "Well, let's see if you can be slowed down a little," he said. With a twisting, upward heave, he threw the handful of nails back over the car's top so that they would land in the center of the road. Another handful, then another, until he had emptied the box and gathered up all the loose nails in his lap. Then he threw the box out the window and started crowding it again. "It'll take a little while," he told the dummy. "The nails will plug their own holes for a while, but pretty soon they'll start ripping the tube, and then those guys are going to have a nice long walk." "You're pretty cagey," the dummy said. "You got out of that better than I thought you would." "Let's hold the celebrating for a while," Bo said. "We may have to sow a few more seeds of kindness." The light was still behind them, growing, snuffing out again, seeming not to move very fast, but keeping up, not more than a half mile behind. The road leveled out, and he took the stretch at a run, hitting it up to 50, pouring his weight recklessly on the throttle. At the slightest beginning of a bend, he eased up. The quickest way to get nabbed was to wreck yourself. He could see no lights now. The road swung left, then right, and his own lights showed him rounded, grassy hills instead of the rocks and pines of the pass. He was getting down. He watched the mirror, waiting for the flash. None came.
"You must have got him," the dummy said.
"Maybe." He kept looking back, but all the way down out of the hills the road behind was black, part of that unknown and unreal world the single lighted reality of the Essex hurtled through. It was all right. Those cookies were sitting on their running board right now, cussing, and he hadn't even hit a bump hard enough to shift the load or break a bottle. Still, he had been chased, and the pit of his stomach was even yet a small, pulsating, sensitive hole. He breathed his lungs full and yelled aloud, letting off pressure. After a while, he began to sing.
When he had sung himself normal again, he slid down in the seat, pulled the gas lever down, and rested his throttle foot, wiggling it to limber the ankle. "I wonder," he said to the dummy, "if those proies were tipped off by our friend Jaime." "He'd have had to work fast. It doesn't take long to put in a telephone call," Beau said. "Only thing is, how would he know what road I was taking and when I was leaving?" "He could have had your house watched," the dummy said. "And for that matter, remember the lights that followed you down to the fork past Armington? Suppose one of Jaime's boys was in that, just tailing you to see which road you took. Once you were on this road, you couldn't get off." "By God," Beau said, "there might be something in that." "But if that's the way it was," the dummy said, "those guys in Nyhart would have known within a few minutes when you'd be there. Wouldn't you expect them to be parked across a bridge waiting to stop you?" "Yes," Beau said, "I would. I don't savvy this business at all. You'd say those guys were chasing us, wouldn't you? They weren't out driving for their health." "No. So they must just have got careless and let me get through and then tried to catch me." He began snapping up the side curtain, hearing through the opening the noise of the tires, the flip and pop of pebbles, the swish of running rubber. It would have been the easiest thing in the world for him to blow a tire himself, hitting that road the way he had. The last look behind showed him only the empty face of the dark, and he buttoned himself in. He came to a fork and stopped. There were no signs, but the main traveled road led on. The other must cut off to Harlowtown. There was only one thing to do when he didn't know the country. He took the main road. His watch said 1:45. He must be more than halfway to Livingston. He might make Billings for breakfast. Or he might, if he found the road good that way, cut down through Yellowstone and angle across Wyoming until he hit the Lincoln Highway. That would put him a long way around Sheridan, just on the chance Jaime's tip had been worth anything. "How about it?" he said. "Want to see Yellowstone Park, baby?" "It wouldn't be open," the dummy reminded him. "We could circle around it. There's a road down the west side. Or there's one cuts over into Wyoming near the east entrance, around Cody. That'd be better." "Save your plans till we get past Livingston," the dummy said. "Once we're that far, we're past anything Jaime might have had up his sleeve, and then we can really make it a honeymoon." Beau settled back, relaxed into the torpor of driving, the unthinking suspension of mind, became once more the set of faculties in the forehead of the beast, eyes and ears for the road and the motor, hands for the steering. He noticed that they were in a flat of some kind, probably a river valley. Thin willows slid by. The road became wallowed sand. He shifted as a precaution, and a moment later came to a peering stop as the road disappeared and became merely two planks with 2x4 flanges, a skimpy skeleton of a bridge walking a foot above the deep sand of the riverbed. It was hardly wider than a railroad track, but perfectly safe and solid if taken easy. He eased out onto the planks. It was like driving on an extended grease rack. The new sensation jogged him, and he sat up. "This is one way to make a road," he said to the dummy. "Damn it if it isn't a pretty good idea, long as nobody's coming the other way." He peered out, trying to see if there was water underneath, but all he could see was dimly luminous white sand and the occasional dark blob of willows. But he stared so persistently, trying to make out what it was he was crossing, that he almost ran into the obstruction in the road. His foot slapped on the brake. The Essex halted with its nose almost against the barrier, and in the light he saw the stack of railroad ties 3 feet high laid across the planks. A trap. He knew it instantly, coldly, furiously, even before he saw the shadows start up from beside the road. Before he heard their shout, he had slammed the Essex into reverse and was backing up, tightrope walking the narrow planks, driving blind, by ear, by feel, his breath stilled in his chest and one arm rigid across the wheel, the other ripping the side curtain out so that he might lean out and crane, steering by the gleam, the glimmer of his tail light. He felt the tires start up on the low flange of 2x4 and then pinch down again, but his foot on the throttle didn't relax. The car roared full speed backward into the dark, along the car track road. The figures which had leaped from the roadside were running after him. Out of the very periphery of his vision, he saw one stumble and go headlong off the runway, and he heard them yelling. The first shot throbbed in his ears, but it didn't mean anything. All that meant anything was the tight wire of plank unreeling under his left hind wheel. If he could hold her on it, get back to the road, he had a chance yet. They would lose time getting to their car, wherever it was. He could run back to the Harlow Town Fork, cut down on that. Lights blazing, he was a beautiful target, but he didn't dare switch them off. He needed their glow. Pink flashes stabbed the dark, but the running figures were dropping behind, and his blood leaped. Another 100 feet, and he would have outrun them, even in reverse. Then a quick turn, a dash back to the forks. The wheel kicked out of his hand, numbing his locked wrist, and the front wheels were wrenched up and sideways, swerving the car, bucking it up over the flange, dropping it down awkwardly angled across the tracks. There was a heavy crunch from the shifting load, and for a moment the car hung uncertainly, about to go over, before it settled back. Before it had quite settled, Beau was on the ground, crouching. The Essex sat with its front wheels high, the tires still revolving slowly. The headlights burned like furious eyes up into the black. He heard the pound of feet, sodden in the sand, and with no more than a second's hesitation, he turned and ran. Chapter 3 He came so quietly that she didn't hear him at all. She simply looked up and he was there, his face blackened with new beard, his overcoat ripped from one pocket halfway to the hem. In the instant when their eyes met, it crossed her mind that if he had not been her husband, she would have been frightened to death at his face. "Beau?" He sat down and stared at her. His trousers, she saw, were also ripped, and there were scabbed scratches on hands and wrists. He made a disgusted sound and spread his hands. "Kaput," he said. "Gone. Load, car, everything." She said the thing that was instantaneous in her mind. "But they didn't catch you." His stare was almost contemptuous. "They weren't after me. They could have had me if they'd half tried."
"I don't understand," she said.
"It wasn't the law."
"Then who?"
"Hijackers." He had straightened it out in his mind on the way back. The pieces fitted. First that car tailing him out of Great Falls, seeing which road he went. Then the two waiting in Nyhart, letting him go by, closing in behind him. Then the barricade. It was neatly planned, and far enough away from everything so that there was no chance of anyone blundering by and spoiling it.
"I should have caught on in Nyhart," he said. "That's where I saw the car parked against the garage."
He rubbed his emery paper jaw, the story coming out past the tips of his teeth.
"I still thought they were the law then. By Christ, I don't know what was the matter with me. I ought to have my head examined."
"But,"
she began, and even that one word of expostulation or lack of understanding made him furious.
"Does it stand to reason that two cops would sit in a town waiting for me, knowing I was coming in a few minutes, and then go over for a cup of coffee and let me slide right on by? Does that sound like sense?"
"No," she said, "I just—"
"It isn't sense," he said. "Those guys didn't want me there, either. They just wanted to let me pass so I could run down into their little trap. They weren't taking any chances of me getting away, I'll say that for them."
"But how could they know so well?" Elsa said. "It sounds as if they knew every minute what you were going to do."
"They did."
"But who could have?"
"There's only one son of a bitch in Montana that could have known or guessed that much."
"Jaime?"
"Jaime."
"Now what?" she said, watching him steadily. "Are they after you?"
"I don't know. I doubt it."
"What will we do if they are?"
"I don't think they are. I think this is Jaime's little way of inducing me to come in with his crowd."
"You won't," she said.
"I don't know. If we want to stay in this town, we may have to."
"Then let's not stay in this town," Elsa said.
There were tears in her eyes.
"I don't want to see you mixed up with those people. They're criminals. They'd rob and murder and do anything. You don't want to go in with them, Beau. You know you don't."
You're exactly right, Beau said.
But what are we going to do?
He stood up impatiently, fingering the gash in his overcoat, his eyes vague and troubled.
I don't know, he said. I've got to figure it out. All I know is that if there's a good chance to get even with that little silk-shirted bastard, I'm going to.
You'll get yourself killed.
Not if I'm careful.
She shivered and half-turned.
You didn't tell me how you got away.
No,
Beau said, his words heavy as iron.
I didn't tell you, and I'm not going to.
The fury in him broke out, and he swung around, shouting, How would I get away? I ran like a goddamn jackrabbit. I plowed through sand and tore through brush and walked 1,000 miles and hooked a ride on a homesteader's wagon. How the hell would I get away? Fly?
I'm sorry,
she said quietly. It didn't do to question him when he was sore. Whenever anything went wrong, he butted against it like a ram, and the worse it went, the more violent and stubborn he got. And though he generally got through, the effort outraged something deep and furious in him. He would never learn to climb over or go around. He had to butt right through, and when he got his head hurt, he was untouchable.
But the car gone, and the whole load, $2,000 or $3,000 gone as surely as if they had taken the sum in $100 bills and touched a match to them. It served her right.
She had been thinking of that bank balance almost in the same terms Beau had. She had been seeing ultimate security and emancipation in it. It was just as well for her to learn that security was not there, that the whole thing could disappear like mist touched by the sun.
I'm going to bed, Beau said. If anybody calls or comes around, I'm out of town, and you don't know when I'll be back.
3 days later, he hunted up Jaime in the smoke shop. Jaime, elegant in a lavender silk shirt, pinstripe suit, yellow shoes, had a greeting as mellow as syrup. He led Beau into the back room and sent the counterman for a bottle.
"You made a quick trip," he said.
"What makes you think I've been anywhere?"
Beau said, and stared at Jaime hard. Jaime shrugged and let it go. The bottle came, and Jaime poured 2 shots.
"Here's how," he said.
Beau drank, watching him. It would have been a pleasure to reach across the table and slap that light, secretive smile off Jaime's mouth, but it wouldn't do. You had to know when somebody had you, or you'd wash out fast. Jaime's smile deepened. He twirled the whiskey glass slowly.
"Thought any more about that proposition?" he said.
"I'm willing to listen."
"Ah," Jaime said. "That's what I've been wanting to hear. You're too valuable a man to waste your talents working alone."
Steadily smiling, inviting Beau to make a double meaning out of that if he chose, he leaned his impeccable elbows on the table and dropped his voice.
"What is it you want to know now?"
"I want to know what the proposition is," Beau said impatiently. "How do I know whether it's any good or not?"
"You want to go on hauling down from the line?"
"That's my racket," Beau said. "I don't want anything to do with any still, if that's what you mean."
"Beans can handle that all right."
Jaime pursed his lips, thinking.
"What would you say to a proposition like this? You haul down to us here. Whole loads. You don't have to fuss around with deliveries or collections or anything. Just whole loads. Dump them off and you're clean. And protected."
"What would I get out of it?"
"What's it worth?"
"I can make 600 a load at least, hauling for myself."
"But you take chances," Jaime said. "You take a lot more chances. Law all over the place and getting thicker. And they have to pinch somebody, see? They're fixed not to pinch our boys, so they have to make their reputations on the stragglers and lone wolves. It's a good setup to be in on."
"How much?" Beau said.
"What about 200 a load?"
"Don't make me laugh."
"That's high pay, boy, for a job that's safe as a church."
"But it isn't high enough," Beau said. "And it isn't as safe as you make out, What if I got hijacked?
He watched Jaime's face closely, but Jaime didn't tumble. His face was still smiling, faintly amused.
The organization will take that chance, not you, Jaime said. But I don't think it's much of a risk.
He grew more confidential, huddling across the table and squinting as he figured in his head.
Now look, he said. You're the best man I know at getting in and out with stuff. We can use you, and you can use us. We'd be suckers to work against each other. But that's what we'd be doing if you didn't come in. But 200 a load? Oh, well, make it 250. It's damn good for what you'd be doing.
We aren't getting anywhere, Beau said heavily. Now I'll make you a proposition. I'm willing to come in on any kind of terms that gives me a decent cut. I'll haul down from Govanlock for you for $15 a case, no less. You putting up the money for the stuff and paying me cash on the nose when I bring it in. You guarantee protection, and let me be the judge of when it's safe to make a trip. And if I don't haul for anybody but you, you'd have to furnish me a car.
Say, now, wait a minute.
Jaime had his hands up, warding off imaginary blows.
$15 a case? And protection? And a car? You want a gold mine.
That's what you've got, Beau said. Why shouldn't I want one?
You've got an exaggerated idea of how much there is in this business, Jaime said, still playfully.
He took out a pencil and figured on an envelope.
Make it 12 a case, and you furnish the car, and it's a go.
Couldn't do it, Beau said.
15 a case would be 450 a load.
That's a whole lot less than I'm making now. Jaime shook his head, at first slowly, then emphatically.
We couldn't afford that kind of money.
Listen, Beau said, this is a business deal, isn't it?
What else?
And I'm going to be a kind of hired man in it.
Not exactly.
Exactly, Beau said. And I'll be doing the hard and the dangerous part, and you know it damn well. So I'm worth wages enough to keep me interested in working hard for you, and it's up to you to put up the car. You don't ask a truck driver to furnish his own hack.
Suppose we did put up a car, Jaime said, after a pause. Would you haul for 12?
15.
Then I guess we can't get together.
Jaime's voice grew crisp. 12 a case, and we'll put up a car that's as deep as we can go. Take it or leave it. For a moment, Beau hesitated. He didn't like it at any price, but there wasn't much else he could do.
Okay, he said finally. I'll take it.
Chapter 4 Toward the end of May, Beau came home from town with his special look of excited secrecy, his air of being possessed by great schemes which could only be divulged little by little with suspense and the aggravation of Elsa's curiosity. He began by asking quite casually if she wanted to go on a little trip.
"Up to Govanlock?" she said.
"No, a real trip."
"Sure, where?"
"Yellowstone, maybe? Salt Lake City? All around."
"You mean just for the trip?"
"Sure."
"Kids, too?"
"Kids, too."
"That would be wonderful," she said. "Can we afford it?"
Beau's wink was almost grim.
"I'm going to see that we can afford it. This is where I catch up a little on Jaime and his outfit."
"Oh," she said, and her animation faded. "You mean we'll be hauling a load?"
"For the love of Mike," he said, "did you think we could go off touring just for the fun of it?"
"Some people do."
"Some people are richer than we are, too. Come on out in the garage. I want to show you something."
He took her out and showed her. An auto tent, folding beds that hooked to the running boards, a food box bolted to the right front fender, with shelves and boxes and a lid that folded down for a table.
"Everything the very latest," he said. "This is due to be a trip in style."
"But the kids," she said. "What if we should get caught?"
"That's just it. With the kids along, we wouldn't even get stopped. No pro is stopping families on a tour. He'd lose his job the first time he searched some big shot's car."
She was silent.
and her eyes came up to meet his.
"It's so much like using them," she said.
He snorted. "They'd have the time of their lives. We'd camp out, see some scenery, take it easy. There isn't a chance for a hitch."
"Where would we be hauling to?"
Bo smiled, his lips tight across his teeth.
"Jaime wants to open up some new territory. Salt Lake City, especially. And I've been such a good dog, he's sending me. It's only incidental that if I get knocked over down there, he'd wash his hands of me and not know anything about any agreement. But that's all right."
"Why?" she said. "Why would you go?"
"Because I can get even with the son of a bitch," Bo said. "I'm taking his load in the car all right, but I'm hooking on a trailer of my own."
"That's double-crossing him."
"You're damn right," Bo said. "The old double X, just what he pulled on me."
He pulled her back to the house, talking all the time.
"I'm going up to Govanlock day after tomorrow. You'll have to pack up and store what stuff we've collected. We've lived in this house long enough. Can you be ready as soon as the kids are out of school?"
"I guess so," she said.
But nothing. This is going to be the nicest trip you ever had."
"I know it would be fun for me. I was thinking about the kids."
"I'll bet you $100 they'd stow away if we tried to leave them behind."
She laughed uncertainly.
"I guess they would at that."
Her laugh died, and she threw him a pained and anxious look.
"I keep thinking of that dummy you took along once," she said. "Now you're taking all of us for the same reason. We'll all be camouflage."
He looked at her with such utter lack of comprehension that she gave up. They pulled out in broad daylight, with the neighbors out to see them off, going publicly like any tourists, their lunchbox high on the right fender, the rest of that whole side wedged with suitcases in the luggage carrier, the tent and camp beds strapped on the iron grill back of the spare tire. In the tonneau, the boys' heads stuck up through a mountainous load. Bo laughed as he packed them in.
"Whiskey to the right of them, whiskey to the left of them, whiskey on top of them, gurgled and thundered," he said.
16 cases of whiskey, camping equipment, food, and 4 people were in the car. They sat on dynamite and waved goodbye to the neighbors and pulled out boldly through the town on the road to Fort Benton. And at Fort Benton, back in a dusty alley behind a warehouse, they picked up the loaded trailer carrying 14 more cases of whiskey and crossed the Missouri and started south. The detour to Fort Benton took them almost half a day out of their way, but it made the trailer safe. Eventually, that night, they wound up in the pass above where Bo had been hijacked in November. The next night, after slogging all day through heavy gumbo mud, they camped in the clear evening with the sun pink on the Crazy Mountains east of them. And the next day they were in Yellowstone, one loaded car among dozens of dusty loaded cars, one family of tourists among the hundreds who peeked into the smoking caverns of geysers and tossed chocolate bars to bears and strung out behind the road construction gangs on dusty, unsurfaced grades through the timber. All of that was fun. Elsa never failed to wave at cars they met or passed. They rarely failed to wave at her, and the feeling of being free and open and in society again, part of a good-natured fraternity of gypsies, pleased her almost more than the scenery. Yellowstone took them exactly one day. In spite of his belief that he was taking it easy, seeing the sights, Bo pushed the Hudson along. A half hour was enough for the canyon. 15 minutes apiece sufficed for 2 or 3 of the more notable geysers. 10 minutes was enough to stop and feed some old robber bear. Elsa and the boys looked enviously at parties starting out on horseback, at enticing trails leading off to Mount Washburn or Cody or the Tetons. For all that, they were outside the boundaries of the park by 7 the next morning, and that night they were creeping through heavy construction again, on the edge of Blackfoot, Idaho. The roadbed was almost impassable, the detours worse. When they were within sight of the trees of the town, they hit a chuck hole that rocked them clear to the axle. Bo winced and gritted his teeth, and the boys whooped from the back seat, pushing the shifted load back off them.
"Smell anything?" Beau said. Elsa sniffed.
"No."
"I do," Chet said. "God damn," Beau said. He stopped the car and got out, sniffing over the load. "Busted one, that's sure," he said finally. "But it would be like hunting for a needle in a haystack."
"What can you do?"
"Nothing now. If we get to a good out-of-the-way camp, I can unload."
Ahead of them, the late sun burned through the tops of a long line of Lombardy poplars, and the roadside was deep green and cool-smelling with alfalfa.
"This is a pretty town," Elsa said. "I don't know when I've seen a town so green."
"Irrigation," Beau said.
There were ditches along the road, a wide canal running off across the meadow toward the north. When they pulled past the big U.S. Royal Cord scroll bearing the history of Blackfoot, Elsa said, "It would be nice if we could camp here somewhere. It's so cool and green."
And 5 minutes later, when they came to the town tourist park, green lawned under a canopy of trees, Beau looked at her once and pulled in. Broken bottle or no broken bottle, this was too pleasant a campground to miss. They found a spot under the trees near the irrigation ditch, and after supper Beau rummaged a little in search of the broken bottle. But the load was too solid, and he didn't dare unload completely now, with tourists pulling in every few minutes and settling down for the night. A car was parked and a tent went up hardly 50 feet away. All he could do was settle everything back in and tuck quilts and blankets in tightly all around to keep the smell as muffled as possible. By 9 o'clock they were in bed. It was barely daylight when Beau sat up abruptly, creaking the iron framework of the bed.
"Hey!" a voice was saying outside the tent. "Hey, wake up!"
He poked his head through the tent flap. A man on a horse was outside, and as the horse moved, its feet splashed in the sodden grass.
"What's the matter?" Beau said, wide awake now, his mind stiff with the prospect of the law. "Ditch is busted loose," the man said. "There's already 2 inches of water running through here. You better pack up and get out, or your car'll bog down."
In the gray light, he kicked his horse closer.
"With that trailer, you might have trouble," he said. "I can get you a team after a while if—"
His nostrils pinched in, dilated once. Beau, sitting up to get shoes on, saw his attention wander. That goddamn smell.
"Thanks," he said. "We'll get out of here right now."
He shouted to the boys and shook Elsa. As the rider turned away, looking back over his shoulder, Beau said,
"How's the road to Ashton?"
"It's all right. Might be some snow up high, but the road's open."
"Thanks,"
Beau said again. He swung on Elsa the minute he let the tent flap fall.
"Hustle," he said. "We've got to get out of here damn fast."
"Ashton?" Elsa said, still only half awake. "Isn't that back up in Idaho?"
"Yeah."
"But—"
"Let it go," Beau hissed. "That damn snooper smelled us, see? We've got to move."
He set his feet down and felt cold water as high as his ankles. The thought of the slippery lawn, the soaked topsoil under the heavy wheels of the overloaded Hudson, made him want to knock somebody down. The Hudson was no good in mud anyway. Too much power, too much weight. A lighter car would walk right through mud that would mire this elephant. In 10 minutes they were packed, the tent and beds and blankets thrown in hastily any which way on the load. Beau slid in and stepped on the starter.
"You get out and be ready to push," he said to Chet and Bruce.
Elsa climbed out too, and the three braced themselves in water that flowed in a silvery sheet over the whole lawn. It had been almost 15 minutes since the rider had left. He would have had time to get a cop and come back if he was the kind that would turn you in. 5 minutes more might be too many to delay. They had to make it out the first time or they were sunk. A graveled driveway circled the park, 50 or 60 feet to their left. If they could make that. Beau leaned out the window.
"Push like the devil," he said. "Now!"
He let out the clutch and felt the Hudson strain, roll. At the first sign of spinning, he eased up, feeding only enough gas to keep the car moving. He heard one of the boys yell and fall down, but he kept easing it, inching it, heavy and lumbering, toward the drive. 10 feet, 15, 3 car lengths.
It was like driving a loaded wagon over thin ice. The minute the wheels started to spin in mud instead of on grass, they would be into the hubs. The lawn sloped slightly downward, a barely perceptible dip, and then upward again to the drive. He would have to run for it. He stepped down on the throttle, felt the clumsy car spin and swerve, but gain momentum. As long as it was downhill, it was all right, but he had to gun it up that slope. In fury, he stamped down on the accelerator and went roaring, throwing mud and water, skidding and whipping back into line, his hind wheels digging in and his speed slowing, slowing, until he barely crept for all the noise of the motor and threshing of the wheels. His front wheels made the gravel, he swung left to ease the hill, and his hind wheels spun, dug, found something solid and pushed him 2 feet, spun again. Elsa and the boys came panting, threw themselves against the fenders, and gradually, painfully, inch by inch, the car crept up on hard surface until one wheel caught. Elsa jumped aside to avoid the trailer. Bruce was flat on his face in the mud, his upraised forehead spattered. Chet trotted triumphantly alongside. Beau started again before they were half into the car.
"Keep your eye peeled," he said over his shoulder. "If you see any cars behind us, you tell me."
"If he believed that Ashton business, we may be all right," he said to Elsa. "But if he didn't, we may have to run for it."
She looked at him with her mouth set, turned her head and looked at the boys, muddy and wet, crowding their faces against the spattered back window. They didn't look scared. They weren't bothered by what might happen. They were only excited. She sighed.
"There's a car,"
Bruce said. Chet crowded him aside to see better, and they fought for the window.
"Nope," Chet said. "It's turned off again."
They clung precariously, balancing on their knees, while Beau drove fast down the straight road to Pocatello. On smooth stretches he took it up to 60, and gravel spanged under the fenders. The tires whined on little curves. The trailer behind wove from side to side. The car rocked with a monumental, dangerous weight on the punished springs.
"Whoopee!" Chet yelled.
He grabbed for the top brace to steady himself. Bruce, a little white around the eyes, yelled in echo, and they both screeched hysterically, drunk with excitement and speed, until Beau turned and yelled at them to shut up.
"Sit down," Elsa said quietly. "I don't think there's anybody coming now."
She looked back a long time. The road was clear as far as she could see, and a white curtain of dust blew eastward to meet the sun.
"You can slow down," she said to Beau. "I'm sure it's all right."
Beau let the Hudson back down to 40, looked once at her, and pressed his lips together.
"That could have been bad," he said.
"Scare you?"
"Yes."
"So that," her mind was saying, "is the end of any pretense that this is a picnic trip. Now at least we aren't trying to fool ourselves any more." It was a day when, having started wrong, they could not do anything right. After the first 100 miles, which they made before breakfast because Beau would not stop until he was clear of possible pursuit, they made bad time. At breakfast, Bruce cut himself deeply with the butcher knife, and in his surprise and pain swore furiously out loud, and Beau slapped him end over end. An hour after they had started again, it clouded over and began to rain, a slow, insistent, misty drizzle. At 3 o'clock, after a cold lunch huddled in the car, they were descending a dugway into a river valley. A yellow delivery truck was coming up the grade toward them, hogging the road. Beau rode the horn, pulled the Hudson as far over toward the edge as he dared, and bent, swearing, to peer through the streaming windshield. At the last minute the truck saw them, swerved, skidded, slewed around, and shot by in second gear. And at the instant the soft clay shoulder of the bank began to give under the Hudson's rear wheels. Beau swung and stepped on the throttle, but the weight of the car bore them down. The trailer slipped half over the edge and pulled at them, and in the end they stuck there, 2 wheels over the edge, and the Hudson balanced precariously on its universal housing like a balancing rock. Very carefully they climbed out the upper side into the rain. Bo's jaw was set, his whole face smoldering. He went to the edge and looked down, walked rapidly up to the next curve and looked back. When he came back to Elsa, he was already shooting out orders.
"Chet, you run over to that farm, see? Over there on the river. See if they've got a team to pull us out of here. Bruce, you go up to the curve and watch for cars. The minute you see one, wave and yell."
To Elsa, he said,
"There's a sheep shed or something right below us. We can maybe camp there tonight, but first we got to get this damn load off and ditch it."
He was lifting a sack out of the upper side, and Elsa moved to help him. He went plowing down the slope with the sack, and even before she could get another out of the wedged load, he was back. His energy was enormous. Put him in a tight spot, she thought. Let him get into a place where something serious might happen, and he didn't even waste time swearing. An intense and terrible concentration came upon him. He was driven, furious, violent. But his violence got things done. In 20 minutes, he cleaned out the car and cached the sacks in the sagebrush, and in another 20, he had the trailer emptied, had unhooked the coupling, and pulled the trailer by hand up onto the road. No cars or wagons had showed up. Bruce still stood huddled under a blanket at the upper curve.
"You and Bruce go down and start a fire if you can," Bo said. "I'll wait and see if Chet had any luck."
So she took blankets and quilts and went through the rain to the shed. It was open on one side, and the floor was paved with dry and trampled sheep dung, but the roof was decently sound. With damp paper and a loose board, she got a fire going and hung the blankets around to dry out. Bruce stood chattering and shivering beside the little blaze, and the sight of his misery epitomized so completely her own disillusion and discomfort that she laughed.
"Well," she said, "how do you like touring?"
They looked at each other. Bruce's solemn face cracked, grinned, and they stood giggling at each other. When Chet and Bo came in to report that the farmer was gone for the day and no one had come by on the road, they were sitting half-dressed, drying out their clothes, and eating a chocolate bar and laughing as if at some uproarious joke. Late in the afternoon, a passing wagon pulled the car off the edge. And that night, in the persistent rain, Bo lugged the sacks one by one over to the sheep shed and reloaded. Early the next afternoon, they rolled around the base of Ensign Peak and looked upon the City of the Saints.
"Gee," Bruce said, standing up to see better, "this is a big town."
"Isn't it nice?" Elsa said. "It's like all the town through here, so green and nice."
Bo stirred and sat up behind the wheel, filling his eyes with wide streets, gutters running with clean mountain water, trees in long rows down the parkways.
"This is something like," he said. "There ought to be plenty doing in a town this size."
They coasted slowly through the traffic, swung eastward up a broad avenue leading to the mountains that went up sheer from the edge of the city. A gas station attendant told them there was camping in any of the canyons, and following his directions, they climbed a long hill to a ledge under the steep, bare peaks, from which they could look back on the city like a green forest below them, and beyond that the white salt flats and the cobalt water of Great Salt Lake far to the west.
"Quite a town," Bo said. "There'd be some point living in a town like this. This makes Great Falls look pretty dumpy."
"Onward and upward," Elsa said. "Excelsior!"
As long as they had lived together, they had lived in little towns, with only that one bad year in Seattle to break the pattern. And as long as they had lived together, he had hated the little burgs. He wanted to get into the big time. The few months he had spent in Chicago, a cocky youngster from the sticks in the incredible metropolis, had been a scented memory all these years. The very name of a big city lighted a fire in him.
"Why don't we move on down?" she said.
She said it as a joke, to twit him about the way he itched for somewhere else, but the serious stare he turned on her said that he did not think it was so funny or even so impossible. In the next 3 days she could see the idea working in him, see the progress from speculation to conviction to enthusiasm. Everything he saw and did in the city fed that fire. The three names which Jaime had given him, a shine parlor operator, a head bellhop, and a brakeman on the D and RGW, were all names that meant solid business. There was a whiskey famine, a reform administration, an active city prohibition force called the Purity Squad, and a consistent record of prosecutions and convictions for bootlegging had steered the whiskey supply to other points. The shine parlor man thought he could use 4 cases. The bellhop could definitely use 2 cases immediately and probably more tomorrow. The brakeman could dispose of 3 cases as soon as they could be delivered. And all 3 had their fingers on the places which were good outlets for whiskey. That night, Beau loaded the car with the 5 cases he had definitely sold, and after dark buried the rest of the load deep under the oak brush. Then he took the whiskey and his family to town, treated the 4 of them to a show and a sticky ice cream orgy in a confectionery store, and drove them home all singing under an incredible round moon that tipped the valley with light like an underwater forest. In his pocket was a roll of $375. In the next 2 days, his brakeman outlet got busy, and before he was through, moved 12 cases. The bellhop and the shine parlor man moved another 4 between them. None of them had even blinked at his asking price of $80 a case. On the 4th day, by dropping the price $5 a case, Beau unloaded all he had left on the brakeman and the bellhop and was clean. "My God," he said to Elsa, "look at the bead on that." He sat in the tent on a folding stool and spread the money on the bed, smoothed every bill out, separated them into piles of 5s and 10s and 20s. He got out an envelope and began to figure his old game. She had seen him, when other figuring palled, sit for 3 hours computing the ultimate fate of $100 left in the bank to bear interest at 4% computed semi-annually for 100 years. He had once even bought a copy of Coffin's Interest Tables, just for the fun of looking up things like that. Now he stopped figuring to count out $560, the cost of Jaime's 16 cases, and laid it aside. Jaime's profit on that was $22.50 a case. He multiplied it neatly, laid out another $350. That left him $1,445 as his own share. He counted it to make sure, bundled up Jaime's roll and put a rubber band around it, figured again. His own net profit was $955. "Holy cats," he said. "I could sell whiskey in this town as fast as I could haul it in. I guess you're not going to have as long a vacation as you figured on." "Well," she said a little tartly, "we might take 2 or 3 days to see the place. You said Jaime didn't expect you back for 2 weeks.
"Yeah," he said. "Sure, we can stay a while and look around."
He looked at the brown canvas wall, his fingers tapping lightly on the bed.
"Say," he said, "did it ever occur to you—"
"What?" Excitement lifted him to his feet. His head lifted, eyes narrowed. He stood hefting the roll of bills in his palm.
"Could you get along here for a week or so, you and the kids?"
"For a week? Why?"
"Because," Beau said, "I'm going back up to Canada after another load."
"But why can't we all go?"
"I want to crowd it. Jaime expects me to take 2 weeks. All right, I'll take 2 weeks. But in the meantime, I'll haul in a load on my own hook."
"It's his car," she said, "and you're supposed to be working for him."
"Yeah," Beau said, "and he owes me a car and a load of scotch."
In the glare of the gasoline lantern, his eyes were glowing slits. Elsa noticed again how the upward curve at the outer edge of his eyebrows gave him a curiously devilish look.
"Besides," he said, "I've got a feeling our dealings with Jaime are almost over."
"I don't know," she said. "If you make this trip, you'll be as bad as Jaime."
"All for hell's sake," he said, and turned away.
In a moment he was back, not to argue, because his mind was made up, but to pursue another strand of the idea.
"I might take Chet along. You and Bruce could stay here and be comfortable."
"How comfortable do you think I could be with him along on a trip?"
He came down this last trip, didn't he?
I was along, she said. I'll tell you right now, Beau, you can't take him. I wish you wouldn't go yourself.
He tossed the roll impatiently in his hand and stared at her.
We'd sure get rich if we followed your line, he said. I can make us $1,500 cold.
I'm not thinking about that, she said stiffly. I'm thinking of what you'll get yourself into. What'll you do afterward? Go back or stay down here, or what? And if you stay down here, what'll you do with Jaime's car? Steal it?
I'd just as soon.
Oh, you fool, she said. You'll get shot dead in some alley someday.
Tears gathered on her lashes, and she shook them off.
Go ahead, she said. Put yourself on Jaime's level. Take all the chances you want, but you can't take Chet.
All right, he said. I won't take Chet. Just at evening, 7 days later, Beau bumped off the road into the campsite under the maples. He was red-eyed, sleepless, unshaven, weary, but he had 35 cases on the car and trailer. And the car was a brand-new Hudson Super 6, a mighty 7-passenger behemoth that even under the mud and dust gleamed with an expensive luster. He had not broken a bottle, had a spot of trouble, or been so much as looked at suspiciously, and he was loose from Jaime for good. Jaime's Hudson he had left at Fort Benton. At first he had been tempted, he said, to keep all of Jaime's roll, drive the car over a bridge somewhere, and make out to have killed himself. He could have changed his name, and they could have started out as Mr. and Mrs. Johnson, or Mr. and Mrs. Davis, with a nice fat bankroll. But he had got thinking of what Elsa would say to that, and in the end he had sent Jaime a cashier's check for his share of the first load, and had left his car in a Fort Benton garage with a message that he was through, quitting the business and going back to Dakota. Now, he said, they could really roll. Now their hands were untied and the world ahead of them. During the 10 days in which he was disposing of the second load, he bought clothes, 2 new suits and 3 pairs of shoes and 2 Panama hats. He sent Elsa into town to outfit the boys and herself, and in the evening, a 2-bit cigar in his mouth on the top of the new washed, polished car, down to air their prosperity to the world, he drove them all out to Salt Air and blew the lid in a Coney Island spree. He tossed silver dollars to the boys whenever they ran out of money. He took them over the roller coaster, through the fun house, into the restaurant where they had lobster, which none of them either liked very well or knew how to eat. Once or twice he looked critically at Elsa's dress, and on the way in, driving with the cool night wind stirring their hair above the plate glass wind wings, he told her she'd better go in tomorrow and get something dressy. The stuff she'd bought was all right for every day, but she ought to have something snappy to step out in.
"Isn't this all right?" she said. "Just camping the way we are, I should think this would do. It's a nice little dress."
"Sure it's a nice little dress," he said. He fished for a cigar. "It would do all right in Great Falls, but you can't step out in it around here. You're in the big leagues, Mama. You're out of the bush leagues now."
"Can I have a house to live in?" she said. "Now that we're rich and can have new clothes and a new car and can throw money around at resorts, can I have a house? I'd like to be dry when it rains and have a bath out of something besides a pail for a change."
"Tomorrow," he said, "we'll go house hunting. And we won't be hunting any little dump either."
"When we're poor," she said, "you're as miserly as old Scrooge. And when we make a few dollars, you throw it around with both hands. You need a manager."
"Only thing I need a manager for," he said, "is to add up my money for me. I get so I can't add that high after a while." He blew a whiff of expensive smoke into the air and put his arm around her, driving one-handed like a young buck stepping out on a flapper date. And when she stabbed him in the ribs to make him quit playing the fool, he quelled her with a smoke screen.
Part 7 Chapter 1 Long afterward, Bruce looked back on the life of his family with half-amused wonder at its rootlessness. The people who lived a lifetime in one place, cutting down the overgrown lilac hedge and substituting barberry, changing the shape of the lily pool from square to round,
digging out old bulbs and putting in new, watching their trees grow from saplings to giants that shaded the house, by contrast, seemed to walk a dubious line between contentment and boredom. What they had must be comfortable, pleasant, worn smooth by long use. They did not feel the edge of change. It was not permanence alone that made what the Anglo-Saxons called home, he thought. It was continuity, the flux of fashion and decoration moving in and out again, as minds and purses altered, but always within the framework of the established and recognizable outline. Even if the thing itself was paltry and dull, the history of the thing was not. If one subscribed to the idea of home at all, one would insist on an attic for the family history to hide in. His mother had felt so all her life. She wanted to be part of something, an essential atom in a street, a town, a state. She would have loved to get herself expressed in all the pleasant, secure details of a deeply lived-in house. She was cut out to be a wife and mother, as few women were. Given half a chance, she would have done well at it. But look, he said, at what she had to work with. 12 houses at least in the first 4 years in Salt Lake. Each house with its taint from preceding tenants, each with its own invulnerable atmosphere and that spiritual scent that the Chinese call the feng shui. 12 houses in 4 years in every part of the city. They moved in, circled around like a dog preparing to drop its haunches, and moved out again, without any chance of ever infusing any house with the quality of their own lives. He remembered some of those houses. The first one, the pretentious place with the 2 cement urns like enormous pustules flanking the front walk. To that place his father brought ball players for beer busts after the games, not for any commercial purpose, but because he liked ball players. And because now, feeling prosperous and meeting players who had been famous once in the big leagues, he liked to expand and play glad-hand host. That was about all there was left of that house in Bruce's memory. The brown men laughing with glasses in their hands, and his father circulating around with a pitcher. That house held them 5 months. Then an abrupt declension in style. Perhaps Beau Mason had been knocked over, or had lost a load, or got in trouble somehow. Bruce never knew. But the second house was a ratty old place on the edge of a weedy field. The front door, decorated down its sides with lozenges of colored glass, had a bullet hole through it at the level of Bruce's eyes. In the backyard was a barren pear tree, and the lawn was mangy and run down. In this house, during the spell of hard times, his father started selling liquor by the drink. Bruce remembered coming home from high school and going into the kitchen to avoid the people crowding the parlor. Once in a while, when there was a rush, he had to serve drinks. He hated it. So did his mother. There was almost always a quarrel after one of those afternoons. Then the purity squad raided the house next door and poured barrels of stinking mash out the second-story windows, and Beau Mason moved out quick. He never went back to the speakeasy business, perhaps because Elsa objected too much. Before long he was running liquor in from the coast. A house by the municipal playground, a good one, with big trees and a wide back lawn, a house his mother liked and wanted to stay in. That was the year when a woman named Sarah Fallon boarded with them, and while she studied beauty culture, and Bruce remembered the dimes he used to earn every afternoon, massaging her incipient double chin. The feel of that soft, moist skin clung to his fingers yet, a sharper memory than any other he had of the house. They moved from there because his father got suspicious of the pious Mormons next door. A man who drove a big car and came in and out with suitcases a good deal, but never seemed to have any regular working hours, was too likely to get the neighbors talking. You couldn't stay too long in one place. So they moved, and moved again. A brick bungalow up on the avenues overlooking the long wooded sweep of the city, a 2-story frame house where they boarded a ball player's wife and family one summer, another undistinguished bungalow, an old adobe house almost as old as the city, but cool and pleasant under its locust trees. They melted and flowed together in the mind, a montage of houses crowding the recollections of 4 years. An apartment in a